Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Abduction of Betty and Barney Hill, Alien Encounters, Civil Rights, and the New Age in America, by Matthew Bowman, narrated by Asa Siegel. Introduction. Tic Tacs. Late in the night of September 19, 1961, Betty and Barney Hill were driving home on a lonely state road in central New Hampshire when they saw a flying saucer. What follows is a largely narrative account of their lives before their encounter and for the decade or so afterward. The Hill case is one of the best known and most written about of American cases of strange things seen in the sky, and is regarded as the first case in the United States of what has come to be called alien abduction, in which human beings are captured by beings from a craft in the sky. I became interested in the Hill case because I was exploring American culture in the mid-20th century. The Hills' story seemed to me to encapsulate much of what was happening to the United States in those years. Betty and Barney Hill were a black man and a white woman in early middle age in 1961, supporters of the Democratic Party dominant in American politics in those days. They were active in the civil rights branch of the black freedom movement that pushed for racial integration. Betty was a college graduate. Barney was not. They belonged to a politically and theologically progressive, yet entirely respectable and conventional, Unitarian congregation in their home in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. They embodied both the middle and the peripheries of American culture in those years. They were also, like many Americans at the time, aware of and a bit ambivalent about the concept of flying saucers. Betty was more interested in the idea than her husband. After the Hills saw the craft, Betty Hill remembered asking Barney, "Do you believe in flying saucers now?" He replied, "Of course not." Betty Hill called it a flying saucer because that was the language of the time. The term had grown popular over the past 15 years to categorize strange things Americans were seeing in the sky. A wave of such sightings had been widely reported in 1947, and new such flaps, as they are called, occurred in 1952 and again in 1957. Americans had grown accustomed to the term flying saucers, and many unquestioningly embraced the assumptions it carried. The first was that these objects were technology, something built by intelligent beings rather than things supernatural or living. The second assumption was that technology in the sky was in the province of the American military. In 1948, the Air Force, wary of rockets, jets, and bombers, mounted a study of flying saucers because of concerns that these things were hostile technology, perhaps developed by a foreign power, perhaps the Soviet Union. The Air Force redubbed them unidentified flying objects to indicate their seriousness. The Hills, like most Americans in the early 1960s, believed that the state could be trusted to handle whatever challenge these sightings might pose. In 1958, the American National Election Study found that 73% of Americans said they trusted the federal government to do the right thing. By 1964, that number had reached 76%. The Hills were among this number. They were part of what has sometimes been called the New Deal Coalition, a collection of American voters who, for at least a generation after Franklin Roosevelt's death in 1945, would make the Democratic Party dominant in national politics. They liked the Democrat support for a host of government programs, from Social Security and unemployment insurance to a strong standing military and an active foreign policy. This coalition began to fray in the late 1960s, and by the 1980s, it unwound entirely, made to appear naive by a host of government scandals and challenged by a rising conservative movement on the one hand and liberation movements driven by young radicals and people of color on the other. Amidst the fracturing, trust in government began to plummet, and so did trust in its various appendages. Some Americans invoked the alliance between the state's national security agencies and the corporations that provided them with research and equipment, ominously labeled the military-industrial complex, by President Dwight Eisenhower in a speech in January 1961. In September of that year, the Hills still presumed the good intentions of their government and considered it their obligation to notify the Air Force of their strange sighting. But by the end of the decade, they would not be so sure. In part, then, this is the story of how, in an environment of growing cynicism about the state and the science that the state sponsored, a strange encounter propelled Betty and Barney Hill toward suspicion of traditional sources of authority and a consequent exploration of more esoteric possibilities. It was a path many other Americans traveled in the 1960s. But if the Hills' trajectory was familiar, they followed it for reasons that were their own. They held to a vision of science that involved public discussion, deliberation, and debate. They believed this in part because they were New Deal liberals who believed in responsive government. But they also believed it because they were Unitarians, a denomination that in the mid-20th century insisted that science policy as a way of generating national knowledge should not be restricted to cloistered experts, but open to democratic discussion. The Hills expected that the government agencies they contacted would take their story seriously. But they were disappointed. By the time they reached out to the Air Force, the U.S. government's interest in UFOs had shifted away from the hard sciences of engineering and physics. In a series of reports, panels, and investigations over the 20 years from the late 1940s to the late 1960s, the state turned the problem from a potential technological threat into a mental aberration internal to those who saw UFOs. Sightings were a threat to the psychology of the United States, not to its military power. The Hills found both the Air Force and their own psychiatrists treating their experience as a problem in their heads rather than in the skies. The experience disillusioned the Hills, but rather than surrender their belief about what they had seen, they changed the communities that they looked to for support. They joined the loose network of esoteric practitioners affiliated with what is often called the New Age, and they increasingly embraced conspiracy theory. By the last decade of her life, Betty Hill was writing that governments separate and divide us, describing strange black helicopters she often saw over New Hampshire, and warning that I learned to distrust anyone who offers to analyze anything I find. I am interested in the story of the Hills as an account of the shifting winds in American politics and culture in the second half of the 20th century, and particularly how one family, typical in some ways, quite atypical in others, followed them. I am less interested in exploring why Americans see strange things in the sky than how the Hills, in particular, some of the first Americans to have such a strange encounter, came to interpret what they had seen as something they called first a flying saucer and then a UFO, how they moved from believing merely that they had seen something strange to believing that they had been abducted by aliens, and how this process went hand in hand with their growing skepticism about mainstream authority in American life. This is not an entirely novel approach. Many scholars, beginning with the famed psychologist Carl Jung, have explored and nuanced the Air Force's conclusion that UFOs were, to use a term popular among UFO researchers, psychosocial, which is to say that they were an expression of human feelings about modern life thrown into technological form. Jung's short 1959 book, Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Sky, suggested that whatever the actual external stimulus for a UFO sighting was, Americans were perceiving them as flying saucers, with all the connotations that term implied. The shape was significant. Yun identified the saucer as a mandala, a universal symbol of wholeness and completion that Yun believed people particularly longed for in the unruly world of the Cold War. For Yun, a UFO might ultimately be strangely comforting, a symbol of longing and desire. Many other more recent scholars agree that it is a symbol, but are inclined to see the UFO as a projection of anxiety and unease. Bridget Brown, Jody Dean, and Susan Lepselter have connected belief in UFOs to disempowerment and imprisonment, the sense that Americans, and especially those who believe in UFOs, are not fully in control of their own lives. According to these authors, UFO believers stand outside relentless narratives of national pride, progress, and growth that the American establishment promulgated throughout the 20th century. Modern mass media has connected us, but also has obliterated any possible assumption that Americans might share common presumptions about credibility and truth. Modern science has made possible great advances, but it has also rendered citizens passive subjects of machines and technology they do not understand and cannot control, particularly in such intimate regions as their own bodies. Modern America celebrates freedom, but many people find themselves captive to financial, racial, and historic oppressions. The story of the UFO, told as a story of strange invasion, abduction, and captivity, finds resonance as it explores and touches on these truths. The seeming outlandishness of alien abduction might seem less unfamiliar, and indeed even more plausible, when set against the aggravating and sometimes terrifying realities of, for instance, modern medical bureaucracy. To some Americans today, the pessimism that has crept into UFO narratives since the Hills told their story of frightening abduction might seem prescient. In American popular culture, alien abduction is told in stories designed to frighten or unnerve. That was, at times, how Betty and Barney Hill told their own story. And yet, we should not conclude that UFOs are simply signs of fear and unease. Rather, even if they are the product of no more than creative misinterpretation, they have also served as grounds for a new sort of world-building, the rewriting of disempowerment into a strange new power. In 1994, the Harvard psychologist John Mack argued in his controversial Abduction: Human Encounters with Aliens that UFO encounters sometimes left those he interviewed with what he called a new and altered sense of their place in the cosmic design, that left them at peace with new knowledge and beliefs that revived their sense of efficacy in the world around them. That was Betty and Barney Hill's story as well. Their reshaping of the reality they believed in grew from the frightening and disempowering aspects of their experience and from the promise of renewed and different potential realities as well. One benefit of a close examination of the lives of two particular abductees, to use a term the Hills adopted to describe themselves, is to trace the evolution of their stories and beliefs about their experience alongside and through their experience in the United States in the 1960s and 1970s. By closely examining the shifting patterns of the Hills' story, how they told and retold the story as their contexts and experiences and even memories changed, I track how their beliefs about their world and the power they had in it changed as well. When they began their journey down New Hampshire's Route 3, the Hills' world made sense to them. They had clear ideas about what science was, about the relationship between Americans and their state, about the meaning of race, and what good, appropriate religion should be. One way of thinking about what happened to them is not to explore what the light they saw actually was, an ultimately fruitless quest, I think, but to see the reality of its power in their lives. It upset and blurred the boundaries they had laid down. The hills grew less certain about what was science and what wasn't as they sought to reconcile what they believed they had seen with what scientific authorities told them was possible. Because the state did not respond to their experience as they hoped it would, they grew increasingly frustrated about the role it should have in their lives. That, in turn, cast doubt upon those scientific authorities, and more, upon whether or not legally enforced desegregation would bring about the sort of integrated society they hoped for. They had thought that religion was one thing, the congregational, respectable, rational Unitarianism they had adopted, and now they came to wonder if it could be something else. The weirdness of what they encountered that fall night was not only a puzzle of itself. It destroyed the presumptions they had about the world. The social and cultural lines that delineated reality in American society faded in the harsh light of high strangeness. That was why Barney Hill said, "Of course not," when his wife asked, after seeing a strange light in the sky, whether he now believed in flying saucers. Barney believed then in racial uplift. He hoped that respectability would bring equality, and the light in the sky seemed to threaten that goal. By 1961, flying saucers were the stuff of disreputable fanatics and the uneducated. It was aggravating on multiple levels when Barney found himself not believed, and he and his wife reshaped the boundaries of authority, legitimacy, and respectability in their worlds in recompense. By the 1980s, the Hill story was famous. In 1966, a journalist named John Fuller published The Interrupted Journey, a book that told Betty and Barney's story between September of 1961, when the two saw that strange light in the sky, to the spring of 1964, when they concluded hypnosis and emerged reporting newly recovered memories of their own close encounter. They now remembered small, human-like beings who kidnapped them, took them aboard that light, which turned out to be a craft, and subjected them to medical experimentation. They told this story repeatedly to Fuller, to the news media, on television. In the decades that followed, investigators, or ufologists, like Mack and the New York artist Bud Hopkins, formulated a template for a certain subset of encounters, like the one Barney and Betty Hill described, and termed them abductions. Both assumed that such experiences were encounters with extraterrestrial life that had reached Earth via spacecraft. Both interviewed dozens of abductees and wrote books trying to systematize the phenomenon and determine what these other beings were trying to accomplish. Hopkins acknowledged the Hill case to be a central archetype, a classic illustration, the model from which many other abduction stories took their frame. Unlike later abductees, the Hills did not have the benefit of a template for their narrative. Their story was told and retold many times, and it grew in the telling. But this should not be merely a signal of its unreliability. Rather, their retellings reflected the various authorities they turned to. The military did not seem interested in the Hill story. Psychiatrists pathologized it. White supremacists used it as evidence of the Hill's unreliability. As the Hills moved from meaning to meaning, not only did their confidence in these authorities begin to wane, but so did their perception of knowledge itself. And finally, they embraced conspiracy theory. By the end of the 1960s, they, like so many others, had lost much faith in the American state. The scandals of the Vietnam War and the Nixon administration opened pathways the Hills and many others were willing to venture down. Their story can help us understand why it was that they, and so many others, found the possibility of extraterrestrial intelligences visiting Earth plausible, just as Americans' trust in each other was beginning to dwindle. As UFO researcher Stanton Friedman put it, linking together demonstrated deceptions in American society to those he and other UFO believers merely suspected, the United States faced a cosmic Watergate. By the end of the decade, Albuquerque businessman Paul Benowitz was marshaling evidence that the United States government was operating a secret base under the New Mexico town of Dulce for the purposes of joint human-alien military maneuvers. Betty Hill was writing about black helicopters surveilling her friends and faceless government bureaucrats rifling through her mail. The scholar Michael Barkin has identified conspiratorial thinking as its own strain of politics that flourished in the cracks of the New Deal order, a strain of politics that downplayed belief in common identity, in good faith debate, and in pragmatic policies. Instead, conspiracy theory emphasized the helplessness of individuals and cast suspicion on the efficacy of democracy, locating power in a shadowy and sometimes interchangeable elite. Conspiracy theory grew among those who either rejected conventional politics, like many white advocates of the New Age, or those whom it failed, like black Americans. And many UFO believers, as they felt rejected by the American establishment, like the Hills did, embraced this alternative. The issues that strained the Hills as they sought to come to terms with their experience remain unsettled in the early 21st century, and of course, UFOs remain as well. On November 14, 2004, Kevin Day was serving as a radar operator on the USS Princeton, a small missile cruiser traveling with the USS Nimitz, one of the largest aircraft carriers in the world, a nuclear-powered warship the size of a football field, engaged in exercises off the coast of San Diego. As the Princeton cruised in the Pacific, Day sat in front of his radar screen, staring at strange clusters of 5 to 10 blips. They were moving too slowly to be regular aircraft, around 130 miles an hour. They were too high up to be birds, around 28,000 feet, nearly the height of Mount Everest. They rose and plummeted and vanished out of radar range, over and over. Finally, Day asked David Fravor, commander of the Nimitz fighter plane squadron, to investigate. Fravor was on a training mission with another pilot when Day contacted him. They had taken two Super Hornet aircraft to a point around miles off the coast. He said when he arrived at the spot to which Day directed him at first, he saw nothing, but then he looked down. The ocean's surface was frothy and roiling. Darting back and forth above the churn was a dull white cylinder that Fravor pegged at 40 feet long. He said it looked like a tic-tac. Suddenly, it darted away. "It accelerated like nothing I've ever seen," he told the New York Times. An hour later, another pilot found the object, or one similar, and filmed it. The camera footage captures a whitish, oblong shape that suddenly darts from the frame. Fravor's story was part of a cascade of revelations that began with a 2017 story in the New York Times that described the Nimitz encounter and culminated in a host of summer 2020 disclosures from the Pentagon, including the declassification of several very similar videos. The Times story claimed that in 2007, Senator Harry Reid had commissioned the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, AATIP, a small operation in the Pentagon that appeared designed to evaluate UFO sightings. $22 million was poured into AATIP, much of it used to pay contracting fees to an associate of Reid, a billionaire and UFO investigator named Robert Bigelow, who ran an aerospace research firm. Over the few years that followed, other sightings occurred, and other investigators claimed that AATIP was only a portion of a much larger investigation that Reed had initiated years earlier. Reed suggested that though he did believe something strange was happening, observers should not assume that the money was put up to investigate aliens. After all, he pointed out, UFOs simply refers to unidentified flying objects, not necessarily extraterrestrial craft, and such a study might be valuable for military reasons unrelated to alien life. Reed noted that many government officials had begun using the acronym UAP for Unidentified Aerial Phenomena rather than UFO, hoping to avoid the weird associations the latter term conjured. But he continued to use UFO himself, and in this book, I will do the same. It was the term the Hills used. Claiming that national security validated the study of strange things in the sky, and insisting they might be no more than advanced earthly technology, put Reed in the same camp as some Air Force officials who first took the story on. But it was evident that other figures in the story believed in other stories UFOs might tell. One, Luis Elizondo, is a former staffer in the office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, who claims to have run AATIP. He treats the Navy videos as a warning of sinister government conspiracy. I took my mission of exploring unexplained aerial phenomena quite seriously, Elizondo told the Washington Post. He claimed he resigned because the Department of Defense would not give his investigation the resources that the mounting evidence deserved. He darkly assured journalists that he knew the Department of Defense would hide his involvement in the program. When you disestablish an organization, there's a paper trail, he said. You won't find one for this program. It is easy to forget that behind the dizzying spiral of names, bureaucracies, revelations, and denials is the simple strangeness of those videos, just as the Hills experience began with a strange light in the sky that Betty Hill fumbled to describe. Media commentators, UFO investigators, and scientists labeled the odd objects in the Nimitz and other videos everything from genuine evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence to equipment artifacts to drones to odd weather events. Each of these acts of interpretation drew the primal strangeness of the Tic Tacs into differing networks of meaning and ways of understanding the world. For Reed, the fact of strange flying objects in the sky validated his concerns for the interests of American national security. But if flying saucers were alien craft the government was covering up, Luis Elizondo's broad network of conspiracy might be genuine. It should be of little surprise that the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, a nationwide organization investigating UFOs in the United States since its founding in 1969, began in the mid-2010s to struggle with growing numbers of members attracted to political extremism and the conspiracy theories stoked by President Donald Trump. Doug Wilson, MUFON's director of investigations, told the Washington Post that he had once believed that UFO believers were sympathetic to marginalized communities because they themselves had once felt dismissed. But he was increasingly worried about strains of extremism in the organization. Of course, as Wilson acknowledges, there may never have been a time in American history when UFO belief has not been bound up with marginalization, suspicion, and fear of conspiracy. The Hills story is then more than a story about the couple themselves and their strange experiences, whatever they might have been. It is a story about two Americans, a white woman and a black man, and what they believed it was to be an American in the middle decades of the 20th century. It is the story of how those beliefs were tested, and how the Hills, like so many other Americans, came to believe something different about the world than they once had. What the Hills said they saw in the sky does not appear to be the tic-tac that David Fravor and other Navy men would report half a century later, but it was equally inexplicable, and like Fravor and the other military men, the Hills interpreted it the tools they had to hand.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?